5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
It's Jen Taub, and today on Booked Up, I'm joined by David Enrich, New York Times Business Investigations editor and author. David wrote several books with very long subtitles, including Dark Towers, Deutsche Bank, Donald Trump, and An Epic Trail of Destruction. That's one book. His most recent book out this fall was Servants of the Damned, Giant Law Firms, Donald Trump, and the Corruption of Justice. Let's dive in. Hey, David.
Hi.
So I know we're supposed to be talking about your book today, Servants of the Damned. But before we do that, I want to ask you about the latest news about Sam Bankman-Fried. What do you think about him posting bail with his parents' house?
No, I mean, I think it's good to be an accused white-collar criminal, you know?
I wrote a book like that, David.
I know. I've heard about it. I see it behind you, in fact. You know, it's not everyone can afford $250 million to go live in their parents' nice home when they're accused of big crimes.
What I don't understand is how, if I read correctly the story in your newspaper, the New York Times, that his parents simply used their house as security. There was no actual money put down to, in other words, it was that the $250 million bond is, if that's what they owe if he doesn't show up or if he violates the terms of his temporary release, and that no money exchanged hands, right? They just had to say, we're putting our house as collateral. Is that what went down?
You know, to be honest, I've been following the SBF saga just like a fascinated human being for months, right? But I'm not like fully up. And I think that's generally how bonds work in these situations. So it's not like bail where you have to actually put up the cash. I think it's that you get, it's like basically you're on the hook for it if the person were to disappear. I mean, the strange thing about it to me is that I'm sure their house isn't worth $250 million. And
it's probably not even worth $25 million. I mean, right?
Yeah,
it's,
presumably.
I mean, these are law professors, although they are both at Stanford, so.
Indeed. That's probably better paid than most law professors.
Speaking of which, isn't your father a law professor?
He is. Well, he was. He recently retired. He used to be a professor for many years at Northeastern University Law School in Boston.
Oh, so you're a New Englander.
I'm from Boston. Oh. Big Sox fan, Patriots fan.
So you never became a Yankees fan, even though you live in New York now?
I laugh because, no, I am definitely not a Yankees fan, but I have two children and we live, you know, 20 or 30 minutes away from Yankee Stadium. And one of them in particular is a big baseball fan. And you can imagine how that's going in our family.
Well, they have to rebel in some ways. Like my oldest child, you know, I don't know what you majored in. You did journalism or do you major in, what was your
major
in?
No, political science.
Okay, political science. So one of the, you know, sort of humanities slash liberal arts, you know, I was an English major. My husband's an artist. Our oldest kid majored in astrophysics and neuroscience and doesn't love to read. So they're going to rebel. You've got a Yankees fan on your hand, I'm afraid.
I know. That's like a real, it's just, you know, my family gives me no end of grief and I deserve it.
Was he, what was his law topic that he focused on? is legal, a scholarship.
You're talking about my dad, not my son. He was focused on, he taught contracts and state and local taxation.
You know where I'm going with this, right?
I don't actually.
Well, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried's parents are law professors, and his father is a tax expert, and he ends up in this mishigas involving, you know, what appears to be major federal crimes and maybe even tax evasion. And you, on the other hand, did not go, you know, do the Red Sox Yankees flip. I mean, you actually are on the good side looking at things like the role lawyers play in facilitating crime or fraud or other antisocial behavior. So your father might be actually proud of you and not having to put his house on the line.
Yeah, well, let's hope it stays that way.
Yeah, so I hope so. So congratulations, first of all, as a former corporate lawyer. I enjoyed reading Servants of the Damned and kind of, you know, exhaled, you know, that I got out of this, the world in, you know, in the late 1990s, when the big law firms maybe only had 400, you know, attorneys, yeah, not these 2,400 or whatever Jones Day you focused on has. Although, you know, I have to say, I loved my time there, and but I didn't have to work with clients.
Where did you work?
I was at Weil Gotshal. Did they come up at all in your research?
No. Well, I mean, I'm certainly aware of who they are. Uh-huh. I didn't really focus on them at all.
Oh, that's good to know. Yeah, I mean, you know, I worked in the trade practices and regulatory law department. So I was like half antitrust and half like, you know, I worked at advertising promotion sweepstakes. It was an interesting mix. I was never a litigator there at all. In fact, I never did, you know, most people either do like corporate deals or litigation. Yeah. I did counseling from day one. It was really nice. Mm-hmm. And I had been a paralegal before that and had a lot of document production work. So, you know, it was nice not to have to be in either world. So congratulations, the book is doing well. And so is, Dark Towers. It's funny. I typically read books, but with both of your books, I listen to them on Audible. Mm. And I found that they're really good Audible listens. And I don't know if when you're writing, do you read your work out loud before you finalize it, or?
You know, I go through sometimes and not kind of systematically. I have like a very weird way of writing and then editing myself that is kind of evolves from project to project. And I'm not sure I would recommend to everyone. I don't really read. I mean, if I'm really struggling with a paragraph or even like a chapter, I'll sometimes read it out loud to myself. That doesn't help me as much as it helps some people. I find that for me, just actually reading it to myself enough times, I can kind of play it out in my head, but mm-hmm. It's fine. So there are occasions where something is just complicated. I know it's not scanning right where I start to read it out loud. And yeah. things dawn on you when you're doing that.
I wonder, I always do, but I'm wondering if the downside of that is my sentences become shorter.
And I like short sentences.
Well, okay. I'll keep that in mind. Okay. Keep doing what you're doing. David likes short sentences. So I love your work because you're interested kind of in the same topics I am, right? These kind of businesses, in this case, I guess, law, maybe, you know, you have this story in your head that maybe things were better long ago and something changed. I don't know. Is that true? Is that just our way of looking at things? Because, you know, I'm convinced by your argument that, you know, law was once a profession, and when it became more of a business and it had more of a profit motive or imperative, given the size of these places, it wasn't as easy to turn down clients, or it wasn't as easy to kind of settle things out without fighting, because fighting, you know, turns the bills. I mean, people say the same thing about, that's one of the theories about investment banking, right? I'm sure you've heard, I think William Cohen talks about this, that when they went from partnerships into public companies with the imperative, right? Well, blah, blah, blah. So why are you, I guess this is kind of a two-part question, but in Servants of the Damned, do you really, you're kind of, it's an indictment of big law, but you mostly focus on Jones Day. So I guess I'm going to ask you, is it systemic? And even if so, what, you know, why Jones Day, and really, was there a turning point? So there's a bunch of questions, and you can pick whichever ones.
I think the place I would start with that is that, and this is something that's true, I think, for big law firms, big banks, probably most big institutions in general, is that the bigger you get, the more complicated it is to run an organization, and the more pressure you face to keep growing. And it becomes this kind of vicious cycle where the more, you know, the more cities you open in, or the more kind of different types of products you're offering, the more pressure there is to hire more people to sell those products or provide those services, which means you need to expand your revenue, which means you need to hire more people, and round you go. And it really very quickly can, I think, change the incentive structures throughout, not just an organization, but throughout an industry. And I think that's certainly, I mean, as you know, before I started focusing on big law, I was doing a lot on Wall Street. And that's certainly the dynamic that has happened there as well, that when banks went from being just fairly simple, straightforward commercial banks, there's certainly plenty of bad behavior, but the incentive structure changed very radically and very quickly in a way that really incentivized a lot more risk-taking and meant that there was much less downside to playing around with money and taking huge risks. And I think that's true for certainly big law firms as well. And Jones Day, part of the reason I picked them was that they went, you know, there's been this kind of revolution in the legal profession over the past 40 or 50 years where law firms had gone from being pretty small and, you know, generally located in a single city. And, you know, some law firms would have offices maybe in one and say Houston and then New York, or Houston and
that
Washington.
That was true when I got out of law school, right? That's a Boston firm, or that's the Cleveland firm.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
And that was the way it was up until the 70s. And Jones Day was one of the firms. It was it kind of was and kind of still is based in Cleveland. That's certainly where its roots are. And it was at the kind of vanguard of this national movement to go from being a law firm that was associated first with a city and then with a region, the Midwest, into a firm that had great national aspirations and started expanding all over the country, and then before long started spreading globally. And that's a trend that, you know, putting aside the question of whether that is good for the law firm or good for the law firm's clients, that's something that when that was replicated throughout the legal profession and other law firms started following suit and kind of went down similar paths, and law firms went from being, you know, relatively small organizations with, as you said, a big firm used to be a few hundred lawyers, and now it's a few thousand lawyers. That's a trend that has completely kind of upended the incentive structure and the management challenges of running a big organization. And it means there's a much greater pressure on everyone up and down the kind of internal hierarchy to be more aggressive, pursue profits more kind of assiduously, and to really kind of put blinders on and not focus on quite as much on things like culture or ethics or like what is right for the world and what is just and honest. And instead you focus on how are we going to get our next assignment? How are we going to get our next client? And it's in the moment that seems totally sensible, because you need to do that to be able to keep expanding and providing what most lawyers view as like a really valuable service they're providing. So it's kind of in the moment. And when you're in this kind of rapidly spinning cycle, I think it's very easy to kind of buy into that logic. And I think part of the reason I liked attacking big law is that as a project is that I was new to it and I didn't know it that well. And I think sometimes an outsider has that kind of fresh kind of layperson, slightly naive perspective that is actually kind of healthy to bring accountability to an institution or an industry.
I think that is so important. Enough knowledge about systems and enough skills like your investigative reporting, right? Enough of that, but definitely being an outsider, because then you start to notice, I don't know, sort of insider speak, and you start to, you know, the one thing you noticed is whenever you would question people about why would you take that kind of client on or that corporation, it's always like, well, everyone deserves representation. It's almost like, it's like, you know, the talking point everyone has memorized, but, you know, you don't need to represent a political campaign. You don't need to. Yeah. There are things that have nothing to do with that. I want to ask you, though, you did talk about the systemic piece of it, but what, you know, why Jones Day? You go into some, you focus on Skadden Arps at one point representing Viktor Yanukovych, and you talk about Paul Weiss, but really the poster child here is Jones Day. Was that an accident in terms of that's where your sources led to you, or is there something specific or cumulative about Jones Day that make them the worst?
Well, I wouldn't say they're the worst, first of all. I mean, I think but they are, you're totally right, that is the lion's share of this book, and it's what I focused on by an order of magnitude, maybe multiple orders of magnitude, more than anything else. I mean, look, the short answer is that they were representing the Trump campaign, and their lawyers had staffed the upper echelons of the Trump administration. And as I started to work on this project in 2020, you know, as the Trump administration was coming to an end, it felt like a moment in our history where kind of not only were many of our kind of major kind of institutions that we've all taken for granted all of a sudden seeming a lot less stable, but democracy itself seemed to be kind of hanging by a bit of a thin thread. And I thought it was really important to be looking at the role the big kind of quote unquote reputable organizations, outside institutions like law firms, had played in lending credibility to the Trump administration and the Trump campaigns, given their conduct in the closing days of 2020. I mean, I think to step back a tiny bit, I mean, I've been covering business and finance for first the Wall Street Journal and then the New York Times for for almost 20 years now. And I've interacted a lot with big law firms during that time. And, you know, every time there's a big corporate scandal, there's one or more law firms lurking in the background. And I kind of watched behind the scenes.
Lurking like to clean things up, or lurking because they facilitated it at the outset?
Both. I mean, that's a good question. It's both. And sometimes it's the same law firm doing both things. Other times, you know, one law firm had facilitated a sketchy transaction or some type of kind of borderline activity, and then another law firm is brought in to do an internal review and kind of, you know, either clean things up or whitewash things, depending on your perspective. But the thing that I kind of came to realize over years as a journalist is that a lot of times these law firms are doing a really good job, not just of protecting their clients, but also cultivating reporters like me and giving us a lot of access and information and leading us to rely on them as sources. And I certainly have fallen into that trap myself many times. I think a lot of my colleagues have as well at times. And I came to see the role these lawyers are playing with the media as, you know, a little bit manipulative, but also just intentionally or not, the effect was that the mainstream media very rarely would dig into big law firms or big lawyers, or even the big law industry. It's a multi-billion-dollar, most of these institutions are multi-billion-dollar institutions. The industry is obviously comprised of many multi-billion-dollar institutions, and they deserve scrutiny, and they weren't getting it. And
is that why is it a trap? Because it's like you want access is good, or you have these relationships, and so they're friends, or is it like you start to adopt the mindset?
I think it's all of, yes, is the short answer. It's not that you're friends, but you develop relationships with people. They provide you useful information. And along the way, you kind of buy into this slightly kind of patriotic mantra that everyone deserves a lawyer. Therefore, law firms representing clients should not get scrutiny. And I think that's garbage. I think that, you know, obviously everyone who's accused of wrongdoing deserves legal representation, but there's a lot of the legal services that law firms these days are providing have nothing to do with accusing people or defending people accused of wrongdoing. And but I've seen instances firsthand where law firms, where news organizations have on rare occasions kind of turned their sights onto law firms and written or been reporting on critical stories about the inner workings of law firms. And I've watched as senior people at some of these firms march into the news organization's building, like physically, and make very clear that the access that their reporters have enjoyed and the information that has been kind of funneled into their news pages through sources at these law firms will evaporate if the news organization writes critical stories about their law firm. So it's not like a quid pro quo, but there's definitely, the law firms gain leverage by being such good sources. And they, at least in my experience, I've seen them basically threaten to cut off that access if investigative reporters pursue or publish negative stories about their institutions. And to me, and I think probably most of my colleagues as well, there is nothing that like turns us on more as investigative reporters than powerful people exercising their power in such egregious ways.
And meaning that you want to continue to pursue it as a result?
Yeah, I want to pursue things that people tell me not to pursue. That's why I got into journalism. It's like a very constructive way to challenge authority figures.
I'm just incredibly inquisitive. I mean, I'm not a journalist, but I was in college and then did the law thing for a whole number of reasons. You know, it is, it's funny. It's like the opposite of Robert Mueller. Like they say, if someone tells me there's a red line, I'm like, oh, really? Thanks for pointing it out. Cause now I know where to go. What the heck? I want to ask you about sources. Both books that I've read, I know there was an earlier one, too, called The Spider.
Everyone always forgets The Poor Spider Network.
It's great.
It's good. Okay. It's all good.
You use sources and different, probably it seems to me that there were many more sources for your latest book, Servants of the Damned, than Dark Towers, and sort of a different origin story.
Yep.
So I guess I want to start first with the most recent book and get into the more emotionally complicated stuff after about Dark Towers. But roughly how many, you know, people did you reach out to? How many of them got back to you? I'm curious whether that process of, you know, wondering whether evaluating a source, even if people are being honest and aren't shading things, that's impossible. Everybody has different kinds of memories. Right. And there might be, anyway, all this stuff about like how to choose, how to evaluate. And does it end up kind of being the book really reflects certain sources that you felt were most reliable that you could corroborate? I'm curious about the numbers and sort of the process.
Yeah. I mean, I don't remember the numbers exactly. And I think I ended up talking to close to 200, maybe like 180, 190 people for Servants of the Damned. And, you know, that's maybe 50% of the people I reached out to, give or take.
So that's That's a good.
Yeah, right? It's not bad. It's I'm making up these numbers to be.
Yeah,
to
I
be
know,
clear,
but your sense is you got a decent, you got like 50-50 response rate, kind of.
Yeah, and probably give or take. And I think part of that is just that, you know, the more experience you have reaching out to sources and trying to kind of frame to make persuasive cases for them to speak to you, the better you are at doing that. And you know, the trick with sources, it's very complicated to get people in different situations to talk to you, but it always boils down to basically the same thing, which is that no one is ever going to talk to you and tell you what you want them to tell you unless they perceive it as being in their interest to do so. And so the trick as a journalist is always to figure out how to help sources come along and perceive it as being in their interest to talk to you. And that, you know, depending on everyone has different motivations and reasons to talk, but you need to kind of work within, you need to kind of try and understand their psychology a bit. And and I think at the end of the day, you talk to dozens or, you know, hundreds of people for a story or for a magazine article or for a book. And ultimately, like the role of the journalist or the writer is to do their best at the end of the day, to distill everything they've learned and arrive at the closest approximation you can to the truth. And that's obviously something that's inherently subjective, and but it can be based and informed very heavily by everything you've learned. And that means you've got to filter people through with many different layers of kind of scrutiny. And you've got to evaluate the facts they're presenting line up with what other people are telling you. You've got to assess what biases they have, if they have kind of personal agendas or, you know, don't like someone or don't like an institution. You have to kind of think about what threats they may perceive to themselves or their professional, you know, success. Like if they speak honestly, do they have an incentive to lie in favor of someone? You know, there's...
Or have they spoken to each other to get their stories straight, even if, I
100%. Yeah, you really need to... I mean, it's just kind of normal common sense to a large degree, right? You just need to maintain a lot of rigor while you're trying to sort out how to weight different accounts of things properly. And in a newspaper article or a magazine, in some ways that's cleaner because you just have much less, you need to be much more rigorous in a newspaper or magazine article about attributing things to specific people. And if someone, you know, even if you think you know something, if you don't have it on the record from multiple sources and someone then disputes it in an on the record capacity, you need to be very careful that you've got, you know, you're either going to say something or you're not. And it's, you got to be careful. And I think one of the things I enjoy about writing books is that, you know, you have more space. And so you can kind of dive into the nuance of that a little bit more. And so if someone, if you've got five people saying one thing and two people saying another thing, you can kind of explain that to readers and say in your own voice which perspective you find more credible. And it doesn't necessarily come down to five versus two or on the record versus off the record. It comes down to this kind of complex stew of factors that as an author and an expert, you are, I think, not only allowed to, but almost obligated to help readers kind of sift through that because you're an expert. And I
love that. Yeah. You know, what you're talking about now about saying, you know, these are the limitations of not actually being in a room with a camera recording reality reminds me of, I don't know if you've read Diana Enrique's book, Wizard of Lies.
Yep.
About Madoff.
Yep.
You know, and this is, I think she did a fantastic job of trying to say, look, this is what Madoff told me when I interviewed him in prison, but I don't, this is the thing I can corroborate. So I'm not even sure if that's true, but here's what I think. I thought it was fascinating and honest. And I like that you also do that kind of thing. You know, one thing that surprised me because I don't, you know, follow every case or I don't always pay attention to who the lawyers were, but I was surprised that Jones Day represented RJR, so Big Tobacco, Purdue Pharma, which, you know, I think the Sacklers are, you know, unquestionably, well, I should have, maybe careful. Obviously, Purdue Pharma pleaded guilty twice to felonies, and I think the Sacklers became billionaires off the backs of, you know, people's dead family who died of prescription overdoses. I write about that. I that's a fact, and I think they don't, they're unrepentant. And they also represented the gun industry. They tried to kill the Affordable Care Act. I mean, it goes on and on. I didn't realize that Jones Day took on so many of those cases. So I think, to me, this book is helpful knowing this. And I wonder whether, you know, when you feature a film like this, I think maybe for Jones Day, it's both a blessing and a curse. I emphasize blessing first because, you know, most people don't remember. It's like advertising. People don't always remember the bad stuff. They just remember your name. Like there was that guy, and there was this like, what was it? I don't know if you read about this a few years ago. Some guy had a really bad eyeglass company. Make crappy eyeglasses on the internet. And because of the search engine, because so many people complained about it, his company went to the top of like the Google search engine.
Amazing.
And got, I know, it's a fucking amazing story, but it's the same thing. Like, is this just going to go, oh, I've heard of Jones Day. They're not for, you know, but big, and also like they're, you know, clients want a badass law firm, you know,
right.
They want someone who's going to win. And so that's the blessing, right?
Yeah, and I think that last part you said is the truest part of it. And they, you know, they are in some circles kind of notorious for taking on not only kind of toxic clients, but also going in very extreme, taking very extreme measures to serve those very toxic clients. And that's not just, you know, defending them when they're accused of crimes, but that's, you know, intimidating local officials that are threatening to impose regulations on tobacco or intimidating witnesses or things like that. But I think what Jones Day is now doing and has probably been doing for some time now is they're kind of leaning in a little bit to this bad boy reputation. And if you're a big company that's accused of harming your customers or polluting the environment or whatever, that having a law firm in your corner that kind of prides itself on taking on quote-unquote toxic clients and has a reputation for standing by your clients even when you're under attack in the media. And I think that's a badge of honor for them. And I don't really blame them for taking that approach either. I mean, there is something to be said for lawyers standing by their clients even when the lawyers themselves come under assault. And that's one of the things I've kind of tried to parse in this book is that And Jones Day has been accustomed to wearing this hat for many decades now. And I think some of the time they've done this in the past where they've represented really kind of polarizing figures, it actually has been really noble. I mean, they've taken on, they've stood by longstanding clients when they've, when those clients have done things that have made not just the clients pariah, but have by extension made the lawyers pariahs. Mm-hmm. And I think the, and from my standpoint, they've kind of lost their way and taken this a bit further than a normal lawyer would in recent years. But I think that they have got, they kind of, they absorb the lessons of some of these battles they had many decades ago. And instead of saying, okay, the lesson here is that we're going to stand by our clients, we don't care if the media attacks us or the public attacks us. Instead, what they've taken that stance and then kind of extended it and gone searching for clients that are the most polarizing and are doing the most damage, and really solicited their business based on that, and solicited them in part by advertising very aggressive, kind of borderline at times legal strategies that go much further than other law firms would. And to me, there's a big difference between standing by a loyal client that is in trouble and actively going out and searching for the most aggressive clients, and then and basically on the basis that you will use your most aggressive tactics to promote those clients' interests. And that's something that, I'm not saying they've violated any laws or breached ethical codes or anything like that, but I certainly think that that's the type of activity that merits rigorous and intense outside scrutiny, and the public deserves to know about it. I do not think that, you know, going and, you know, using your connections inside a federal administration to help defuse a criminal investigation into your client, I'm not saying that's not, shouldn't be allowed, but I definitely think it opens up law firms to scrutiny and criticism. And I think that's a stance that Jones Day has kind of been flat-footed about, because they have internalized this notion that whatever we do, as long as it's on behalf of a client, is kind of intrinsically above reproach. And I think that that is, and I frankly think that that's an attitude that a lot of other law firms have taken as well, and that many people in the media and in politics have just kind of slightly lazily accepted, because it is, it seems to fit under this rubric of, well, everyone deserves legal counsel. And to me, that it's a real bastardization of that concept, and it needs to be reined in. I mean, yes, everyone who's accused of wrongdoing definitely deserves legal representation, but you are not entitled to the best lawyers in the world if you are, automatically anyway, if you are seeking public office, or if you are trying to undermine a regulation or avoid taxes or, you know, hide your money, things like that. Those are not services to which someone has a constitutional right. And I think law firms have just very easily kind of brushed away any criticism of any services they're providing to anyone under any circumstances with this, by kind of nodding at the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights and saying, oh, well, you're criticizing the right to counsel. No, you're not. You're criticizing your right to, like, extraneous legal services that have nothing to do with your right to counsel.
Lawyers can choose their clients. And, I'm much more sympathetic to the idea that you go out and choose a client who doesn't have money or doesn't have access and might be detestable because of, you know, some kind of violent crime. I think that's really harder to do. The idea that someone's, you know, that it's some noble pursuit to, you know, represent someone who, you know, who's paying you $100 million a year, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I will say, just going back to the thing about, you know, the badass reputation, up to a point, like that concept, which is, if I were a general counsel of a company that made a consumer product or service and mostly did good, but, you know, I'm a company that has, you know, 40 or 100,000 employees, stuff's going to happen. And sometimes it doesn't happen at the very top, you know, even though it can. Sometimes it could be some other place. And, you know, I absolutely would want to hire a law firm who would aggressively, you know, make this thing go away or minimize it. On the other hand, there is a too far. In other words, I don't like a law firm, I guess two different things. One, I don't like a law firm whose behavior and practices are so outside the norm that I know they're going to have trouble recruiting top law students. Yep. because there's so much that goes on that can be so complicated that if you don't have the best people at all levels of the firm, I should say the best, a group of exceedingly smart, well-trained, and sophisticated, well-pedigreed people who know how to move inside of corridors of power, know how to get stuff done, know how to anticipate problems. If they're not able to recruit those people, then they're not going to deliver. But the thing that I think would make me not want to work with a law firm, and I don't know if Jones Day was the one in this book, the example that you gave about the couple whose child got meningitis.
Yep.
Was that a Jones Day? Yep. Okay. That, and there was something else, maybe it was there was another example, the lawyer went too far and the judge kind of criticized her and then she retired. I'm not forgetting what the case was.
Yeah, this is the same meningitis.
Okay. Yeah. Can you, because I can't believe what I read. Can you remind me of what happened and tell me how anyone, because this story alone would make me never bring my work to Jones Day.
Yeah, this is
you can find another badass. There are a lot of badass law firms. I would never bring my work to Jones Day after I heard this story.
Yeah, I'm not sure other law firms are any better, to be honest with you. But this is basically my favorite chapter of the book. I mean, it involves powdered infant formula, which I hadn't realized this until I started working on this chapter. But there is a longstanding pattern of powdered infant formula being contaminated with a type of bacteria that can cause a very dangerous type of meningitis in newborn babies, basically under a month old. And it's not that common, but it's, you know, so many people consume powdered infant formula that it happens with some regularity. And so the book focuses on one particular example with a family in Sioux City, Iowa, a poor family that has twins. And after a few days, they start feeding one of the twins, the girl, Janine, powdered infant formula. The boy, James, does not eat the eat that formula. And the little girl, after a day or so of eating this, comes down with what's quickly diagnosed as this type of meningitis. The doctors say she's going to die. She does not die, but her brain is damaged so severely that she'll never be able to walk or talk, or she can't even sit up or swallow. And her life is, I don't want to say her life is ruined, but the family's, it's an absolute tragedy for the family. And so they sue the manufacturer of this formula, Abbott Laboratories, which is the biggest manufacturer of powdered formula in the United States. And Abbott's longtime lawyers are Jones Day. And they have a lot of experience litigating these cases because, as I said, there's a pattern of this happening. And there is a track record of people bringing these cases. Sometimes they settle beforehand for, you know, sometimes even in the low millions of dollars, but that's pretty rare. And so in this case, the evidence, you know, to a layperson seemed fairly clear. You know, newborn babies who are a month old or a week old are not like crawling around on the floor, like picking things up and putting them in their mouth. They're immobile. And so the only thing that's going in their mouth is the bottle. And so, you know, there's only a limited number of contaminants or ways that bottle and what's in the bottle can be contaminated. It can come from the water, it can come from dirt on like the kitchen counter, or it can come from the formula, which is, there have been many scientific and peer-reviewed studies that show that there's a pattern of this exact type of bacteria breeding in this exact type of formula. And, but Jones Day in the run-up to this litigation, just kind of pulls out all the stops. And one of the things they do is they just completely inundate the plaintiff's lawyer, which is the small town lawyer, with so many boxes of evidence that they like completely filled up the judge's chamber in the courthouse when he went to look at them. And during depositions, when the plaintiff's lawyer was deposing Abbott employees before the trial, the lawyer from Jones Day, who was supposed to kind of sit in the deposition and be there, and maybe you object occasionally to lines of questioning, but you're basically supposed to let the plaintiff's lawyer depose this witness. And instead of doing that, the Jones Day lawyer interrupted in every couple of minutes, basically. I think it might have even been more than that, but in hundreds and hundreds of times over the course of a few depositions. And not just interrupting to kind of make the plaintiff's lawyer lose his train of thought, they were also coaching the witness. And this is not me saying this or the plaintiff's lawyer saying this. This is the federal judge in the case, who is a very well-respected, long-serving federal judge, said this on the record. And ultimately, at the end of the day, this goes to trial. The plaintiffs lose. Abbott wins, and the family is and remains, you know, basically bereft and heartbroken and without the resources to take care of their daughter, who is now a teenager, and again, still cannot walk, talk, sit, swallow, any of that. And the way this came to my attention, actually, is that a law professor mentioned this to me just in the kind of context of how a kind of question he asked his law students, which is, look at the conduct of this lawyer, this Jones Day lawyer in this case, and you need to ask yourself, did she years ago when she was in law school say, this is what I want to do when I become a lawyer? And if the answer to that is no, how do you as a young aspiring lawyer kind of work to prevent this exact same thing from happening to you? Because I think it's a very easy slope to slide down. And people go into law school with huge, often with huge debts, or they come out of law school with huge debts. And a job at a big corporate law firm is a relatively easy way to repay those debts, but you get accustomed very quickly to those fat six-figure and sometimes seven-figure salaries. And I think it's a trap that a lot of people slide into without really meaning to.
And they lost this case, this civil case, before the jury. Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's right. I later learned, so I reported this out, I guess it was last year. Was it last year? I've lost track of time. I think it was, must have been 2020 and 2021 that I reported this out. And then at the beginning of this year, the baby formula thing kind of burst into the national headlines when there's a few babies died, and there was, the FDA went into Abbott's manufacturing facility in Michigan, found that it was contaminated with this exact same type of bacteria, shut down the manufacturing facility at that point. And the result was this national shortage of baby formula, and the Biden administration had to airlift formula. And I then learned through some more reporting that Abbott has never lost one of these cases in court. They've settled a few, but they've literally, every single case they have ever brought to a trial, Abbott has won. And to me, that's not a reflection of the evidence being weak or this not being really caused by formula. It's a product of very successful lawyering on one side and just a complete lack of equilibrium and symmetry in terms of the way, you know, the people who are harmed by these products can stand up for themselves. And I think that it's a really powerful example of how skewed the American legal system has become.
Do you have any idea in the case that you wrote about whether they were offered any kind of settlement?
They weren't offered any kind of settlement. There's another case that was occurring more or less simultaneously that the same team of Jones Day lawyers was trying down, and I think it was North Carolina at the time, where the woman is a single mom, also very poor, who had, again, eerily similar circumstances. And she was offered, it was kind of like a token settlement of a couple hundred thousand dollars that was just not going to, that sounds like a lot maybe, but it was not going to make a dent in the millions of dollars of medical expenses they face, like paying for wheelchairs and cars that can accommodate wheelchairs. And things. You know, it's just like...
Well, the worst part, there's so much bad about this story, but what's awful is, as I remember, they were sent home with this bag, you know, with samples. It wasn't like she'd gone out and chosen to purchase it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And Abbott, as part of its marketing campaign, and other formula companies do this too, they give huge quantities of formula to hospitals and to pediatricians, and basically so that they can then hand out these gift bags to either new mothers or expecting mothers. Sometimes they do, Abbott does direct mailings to people who they've, I don't know how they get this information, but people who are expecting their first child. And so the formula that was allegedly contaminated in all of these cases was not stuff that people had gone to the store and bought. It was stuff that had been given to them either by Abbott directly or by other formula companies or from a doctor's office or the hospital.
You would think that the government, like the FDA, could say, well, we found this contamination, and in theory, this could be a violation of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act for introducing adulterated products into, or it would be the FDA, I guess, but it could be a FDA criminal violation, and they could do a deferred, you know, settlement. You could enter into something where it would require them to set up a kind of trust fund because this is going to maybe inevitably happen. I mean, this might be one of these situations where, this is a product that helps a lot of families when they can't nurse or there's no other formula available, but that if over the period of time, no matter how clean you try to keep your facilities, there might be contamination, then it should be on the company to take care of the healthcare costs, right? I mean, is that what's going on here? Or do you think they could have prevented?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think also it's just like, the best case and the most kind of benign explanation for Abbott is that the formula itself was not contaminated, but that the contaminants were picked up, you know, from a dirty kitchen sink or from in the water or something like that. And it gets introduced that way. But that is a knowable and anticipatable cause of using powdered infant formula. And the solution here is not to
And who can self-insure better, right? It's not that.
Exactly. You just slightly lower your profit margins. And again, that's not, I'm not trying to shame the people who are using, I mean, we use powdered infant formula in my house. I didn't even know about these risks. But there's like, it's, this is something that could, the other thing is that this type of meningitis, this type of bacteria is very rarely seriously harmful to kids once they're more than like a 5 weeks old, basically. And so you could have much more aggressive warning labels on these products. You could stop giving them to hospitals where they're being given to people with newborn babies. There's a lot of ways.
Or if they want to continue, I mean, you could create an injunction saying you're not allowed to give these to hospitals and you have to have these giant labels, warning labels, or you have to pay for any time that this gets contaminated. And that would be a really reasonable way to do this. But instead, you hire lawyers to fight each case off. It's not the right way. It's not the way I'd want to do this. I think it'd be in much better faith. It's sort of like the Tylenol moment. Why not just just be more honest about how these things work?
Wait, do you have time for one quick anecdote along these lines?
I have more time for more questions. Give me an anecdote.
Okay, so the thing that I found really interesting in researching John Stay was that back in the 1940s, there was a case that worked out in the exact opposite way that they now handle cases. It involved, there's a huge natural gas plant in Cleveland. And in one day in 1944, it was a Friday, two of the big gas tanks exploded. And they basically leveled an entire neighborhood of Cleveland. And John Stay was the law firm representing the gas company whose tanks had exploded. And so the gas company said, can you look into what our liability is here, how we should handle this? And so Jones Day lawyers spent the weekend researching case law, trying to understand what the gas company's liability was. And they came back with an answer, which was that you basically have two legal options. One is that you can basically try to minimize liability, put the blame on others, like the steel company that manufactured the gas tanks. You can try and blame or kind of minimize some of the losses people suffered. You can kind of protract the legal proceedings so that you basically wear people down and get them to accept lowball penalties. That's not what we recommend. That's kind of the normal course of action. That's not what we recommend. Instead, what Jones Day recommended was that if this gas company wanted to remain in Cleveland and have a decent reputation, they should admit liability and make people whole. And so that Monday, this is, you know, 48 hours after this explosion, the gas company ran an ad in the Plain Dealer newspaper saying, come to our offices today with, say what you've lost, whether it's a family member or a house or whatever, and we'll write you a check on the spot. And so Jones Day set up tables in the headquarters, in the lobby of the headquarters of this gas company, and on the spot cut checks to people who came in. And they wrote something like, in today's dollars, I think it was more than $100 million right on the spot. Mm-hmm. And to me, that is the... Everyone always says, well, what do you expect a big company to do? Of course, they're going to hire these outside guns who are going to do everything they can to minimize their liability and avoid paying people. Well, that's not always the case. And I think this gas company example, to me, is a instance where the lawyers recognized that the client's interest in the long run was better served by doing the right thing rather than fighting tooth and nail to avoid some short-term costs.
Oh, the client's interest. But what about the lawyer's interest, David?
Well, I mean, the lawyer, Jones Day, still has a relationship with that client.
That's true.
80 years later, so.
I love that story so much because I think, you know, that's what you want. You want that kind of wise counsel saying, you know, the different ways to do this. And it was the right way. I mean, there was... You know, when accidents happen, again, because, you know, who should, they could have squeezed the customers, but they were also more located at that time. Jones Day was more, they were part of Cleveland. So they really had that relationship.
Exactly.
They weren't like a Washington, D.C. inside of the administration firm.
Yeah, exactly.
So there was this thing that caught my eye that maybe no one has asked you about, but it's particularly of interest to me. It's in part of the book where you're talking about Don McGahn, who became he became White House counsel for Donald Trump after leaving Jones Day. And early, this is part of the book where you talk kind of about how Domagan kind of worked his way up in the legal field. And some of it was through his association with a conservative lawyer by the name of Benjamin Ginsburg. And you talked about something Ginsburg was involved in the early 1990s, and I want to hear a little bit more about it, called Project Ratfuck. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so Project Ratfuck, you're right. No one has asked me about that, in part because I think they're not allowed to say ratfuck on their
I can
TV
do whatever I want.
Shows. Yeah, I like that.
I know, is that nice?
For what it's worth, so Project Ratfuck was, there's some debate nowadays over who actually gave it that name. I think if someone were to ask Ben Ginsburg, he would probably disclaim responsibility for that name. Who knows what the truth is? But it was basically in the 90s, it was a strategy that Ginsburg helped craft while he was working for the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee to basically do two things at once. One was to, and with the bottom line of basically making white Democrats an endangered species in the southern United States. And the way he did that was that there was a federal mandate, I believe, to have a certain there were basically restrictions on gerrymandering that you could not just completely eliminate people, racial minorities, from having political representation. And so the idea was that you would cluster all the black votes. You draw congressional districts in a way that clustered as many black votes as possible in the smallest number of congressional districts.
So in terms
districts.
Of residents, you would build a district around where you had more of a black population.
Right. And so it would virtually guarantee that you would all of a sudden have black people in Congress, which in the early 90s was kind of, I guess, a novelty maybe. But that meant that the remaining congressional districts were basically avoided having black people or people of color in them. And so the reason it was called Project Ratfuck is that while it hugely helped Republicans by solidifying their hold on suburbs and many other places across the South, it bought the loyalty or won the loyalty of black Democrats. And so it basically divided the Democratic opposition to this. And it was kind of hailed by Republicans, at least, and I think by a lot of political journalists, as kind of this evil genius move that broke the opposition, and therefore, but at the same time, it was a huge win for Republicans, and that's part of the reason that in 1994 Republicans rode to this huge wave, and led by Newt Gingrich, and because mm-hmm. they had just completely and utterly dominated the South, and that was. And for many, I think, honestly, until 2020, that was probably the thing that Ginsburg was best known for.
And that in 2020, he gets known for the whole Florida recount?
That was 2000. But
oh, 2000, damn it. You're right. I'm 20 years.
I'm being a little glib here, but I'm eliding huge.
But wasn't he also involved in the Florida recount?
He was. He was a central player in the Florida recount. He was one of the people responsible for the Swift Boat attacks on John Kerry. He was a very well-known and kind of no-holds-barred Republican political operative. He goes to Jones Day along with Don McGahn. He works for the Trump campaign in 2016 and 2020. And midway through the Trump campaign in 2020, he decides that the Trump campaign is finally going too far and that Trump's attacks on the credibility of the American voting system and unfounded warnings about the dangers of voter fraud were just posed a real threat to American democracy. And he basically, he was in his 60s at that point, and decided that he did not want his last political campaign to involve helping a demagogue destroy democracy. And those are not my words. So he very publicly resigned from Jones Day and took a public stand against, not against Jones Day, but against the Trump campaign in a way that was, I think, proved fairly farsighted on his part, because this is in, I think, August of 2020. And he rightly predicted, and again, this isn't rocket science because a lot of other people saw exactly where this was going. But from a Republican insider standpoint, someone who had been working until recently essentially on the Trump campaign, it was a real, I think, a moment of clarity and a wake-up call to a lot of people in Washington, including in the kind of mainstream political press, that this is something, these threats that Trump was making about not taking the election results seriously if they went against him were something that really needed to be taken seriously. And I, to me, that is the thing that Ginsburg is most likely, or it's one of the things anyway, that he is most likely to be remembered for, not for these kind of machinations that divided Democrats in the South and smeared John Kerry and helped Bush win in the Supreme Court in 2000, but that he was someone who, maybe when it mattered most, developed a bit of a conscience.
A little conscience, a lot late.
That's fair, but, you know, there's, that's fair.
Well, it has been so great finally getting a chance to talk with you, David. And if I had another hour, I'd want to know what you're working on next. And when you actually, let me ask you one last thing before I wrap it up. Do you think Jack Smith is going to indict Donald Trump for anything? And if so, when?
I have no idea. And I have no idea is the bottom line. My track record of making predictions about Donald Trump is just so atrociously bad that
I'm with you, buddy. I'm right there with you.
And it's just not even helpful for me to make these predictions because it's like they're wrong and then I look stupid and I don't know.
Okay, so don't take a risk. I'll take one. I keep saying before March, so we'll see.
Before March? Why before March?
Because if he doesn't, he's a fucking asshole. I just, that's, if you can't do it by March, then I give up. Anyway, it's been great talking with you. Hopefully we
Likewise.
Can, next time in person, in real person, not on
Zoom. I would love to
Zoom.
Do that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye. That was a great conversation with David. If I'd had more time, I would have gotten into something a little more emotional about a source that he had been in contact with for his first book, Dark Towers. I was crushed when I learned about the death of Val Brokschmit, but I was not entirely surprised. He was a person who had kind of blown the whistle on Deutsche Bank. His stepfather, William Brokschmit, had died by suicide in 2014. William Brokschmit, the stepfather, was a senior Deutsche Bank executive, and he was found in his London flat having hung himself. And Val, the next day, found passwords to his dad's email accounts, and he was able to get a hold of a variety of confidential files that he thought incriminated Deutsche Bank. And for a period of around 5 years, Val had, you know, kind of teased different potential outlets, you know, news reporters and the government with these the documents he'd found through these emails. And as a result of this, David Enrich had published an article in the Wall Street Journal that year in 2014, before he joined the New York Times. And that article resulted in Deutsche Bank share price dropping by 3%, three percentage points. That was about $1 billion drop. And Val was a complicated character. There was a piece that David wrote about him in, it was October 1st of 2019 in the Times, called Me and My Whistleblower. And there was a point that after that where it seemed like they had a falling out. And at some point Val kind of was, you know, people couldn't really find him. And we found out that he had passed away this past May. I really recommend folks interested in using sources in the writing process to go ahead and read that piece from 2019 in the Times called Me and My Whistleblower. And with that, I'd like to thank you for joining us for another episode of Booked Up. Please follow Booked Up with Jen Taub on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and email us at bookedup@politicon.com. If you prefer old-fashioned forms of communication, you can send us a letter or postcard at Booked Up, P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts, 01061.
Thank you. Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.